And we will move on to the second case for this morning, Swearingen L. v. Cook County and others. Ms. Kurtz?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dana L. Kurtz, appearing on behalf of the appellant Kenneth Swearingen L. We are requesting that this court reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment in this case and remand the case for trial. There is one overarching issue with respect to the district court's grant of summary judgment in this case. The district court weighed the evidence in favor of the defendants and failed to follow Supreme Court precedent in Anderson, this court's precedent in Lewis and Valentino, that the facts be weighed in the plaintiff's favor and that the evidence of the non-movement must be believed and all justifiable inferences must be drawn in the non-movement's favor.
Well, I mean, to say that this court's familiar with the summary judgment standard is hardly the beginning, but the court is supposed to look at the relevant evidence. And let me just, for convenience, start you on your First Amendment retaliation claim. Supreme Court, as this case has been developing, has decided Garcetti against Sabalos, and it has really changed the landscape for claims like this, and it's very difficult for me to see how Mr. Swearingen, or Swearingen L., if he prefers, could possibly, given what the court has defined as the relevant pool of evidence, could possibly prevail on that point.
Your Honor, with respect, 2 points on the issue on the First Amendment claim. First of all, the defendants did not raise that issue. They only raised that issue in their reply.
But this court is obliged to apply the law as it stands at the time we get the case, if the case is here on direct appeal. And so I don't think there's any way that we could say, well, this intervening Supreme Court decision is something to which we'll pay no attention. I mean, that's just not the way things work.
The reason I raise that issue, Your Honor, is because the plaintiff did not have an opportunity to present evidence in response. The defendant had presented in its reply only General Order 3.8, which is very broad, which Garcetti specifically states, quote, "We reject, however, the suggestion that employers can restrict employees' rights by creating excessively broad job descriptions." Looking at the evidence in this case specifically, he was running in the union election, which the Supreme Court has held as protected activity under the First Amendment. He also had and that's Smith versus Arkansas State Highway, Supreme Court, 1979.
Well, but getting to that general order, which, of course, we've also seen, I can't imagine how that the Supreme Court meant that something like a general order creating a duty to report misconduct would be this kind of overbroad. It's not like go forth and do no wrong. It's if you see misconduct in the jail, you have a duty to report it to your superiors. That strikes me as a very common kind of rule to have and a defensible rule.
And the general order does not specifically, it talks about misconduct. However, that doesn't change the Supreme Court's precedent that union activity is protected under the First Amendment, including the fact that he was supporting other employees, Officer Ogoin, Officer Patterson, Officer Robertson's complaints of harassment and sexual harassment by his superior, Katie Harrison.
All looks to me within the scope of employment. It's hard for me to see how he's presented that particular claim in a way that would get beyond Garcetti.
And, Your Honor, if this court were to find that complaints on behalf of other employees and union activity, that is not what Garcetti intended. And Garcetti doesn't deal with union activities. Garcetti only deals with the conduct of an attorney, and in the language of the Supreme Court's opinion, it is specifically limited.
But it had been years since he had been a union steward.
Your Honor, it had been years since he had been a union steward, but the evidence in the record is that he was running for a union election that was occurring in August of 2003. And looking at the timeline in this case, he started working there in 1986. Defendants admit in their brief at page 5 that he worked there for 17 years without incident. It was not until July of 2003. And backing up before that, in 2002, he supported employees, he made union grievances, he was running for the election that was going to be in August of 2003. November of 2002, he assisted Officer Ogoin in his complaint of sexual harassment against Katie Harrison, the superintendent. In January of 2003, and he testified in his deposition that the statement was made in January of 2003. Harrison told Swearingen that she was going to get rid of all the male officers in Division 4.
Well, could I just say then, let's broaden this out. There's one problem that I think you have with your discrimination claims, and then there's a different problem that you have with the malicious prosecution claims. With the discrimination claims, the problem really boils down to how could you ever show pretext. They seem to think that there was sexual misconduct going on between not just Mr. Swearingen, L, but also a couple of other officers, even including one of your comparators, and they all are disciplined in various ways. It's hard for me to see how that could be found to be a pretextual reason for initiating the disciplinary proceedings that he quits in the middle of. And it's also hard for me to see how that isn't prima facie evidence of probable cause for the malicious prosecution claim.
3 points on that, Your Honor, to break it up. On the gender discrimination claim, there is direct and circumstantial evidence. Pursuant to this court's order in Lewis, there were statements by Superintendent Harrison, direct statements that she wanted to get rid of all the men in the unit. Statements.
So why is he, insofar as it deals with him, whether or not she wants other men in Division 4, she surely is entitled to say she doesn't want men who are engaged in sexual relationships with the inmates.
That's not what she said, Your Honor.
And that's what she does vis-a-vis him. That's why he's singled out.
Well, and he is singled out. There were three African
other people. Right. It's not just him.
There are 20 people investigated, and three were eventually charged. Right? So he wasn't really singled out.
He was singled out. And if you look specifically, going back to the standard on summary judgment, that the evidence has to be weighed in his favor, Katie Harrison specifically testified in her deposition that she did not have any evidence that he was involved or that there were complaints against him. And I attached in the reply to the supplemental appendix the confidential note of July of 2003, which shows that IED received a call from Superintendent Harrison regarding sexual misconduct and naming Officer Swearingen. Now, she directly contradicts that testimony. That she has two depositions. One, she testifies she never received a complaint against Officer Swearingen, and in another one, she said that she did from inmate Nicole Burns. If you look at the complaint and her interview of Nicole Burns, and she admitted in her subsequent deposition that Nicole Burns did not complain about Officer Swearingen.
Why is this pertinent? Because what happens is certainly an investigation is triggered, whether the original letter mentions Mr. Swearingen L or not is, it seems to me, not really the key issue. Eventually, these, as Judge Evans says, these 20 names come out. They pursue it. They find out about Portia Warrington. They look at other people. Some people are disciplined. Other people are not. It's a comprehensive look.
If you look at the record, let's take Paul Usiak, for example, Caucasian.
Caucasian officer.
And if you look at the supplemental appendix submitted in our reply brief, which is the sheriff's office report, on August 13th of 2003, they had already issued arrest warrants for Swearingen, Ogoin, and Anthony. August 19th of 2003, they go to the residence of Paul Usiak. They find former inmate Cindy Rock. They question him, which is at supplemental appendix page 11, on August 18th of 2003. He was not advised of his Miranda rights, of which they had already done to Swearingen, Ogoin, and Anthony, all of whom were African American, all of whom had made some type of complaint against Katie Harrison.
And weren't they all involved with current inmates as opposed to a former inmate?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the evidence in the record...
Mr. Swernigan-L was involved with a current inmate.
No, Your Honor. And that's weighing the evidence in defendant's favor. He testified, and the criminal case found he had not acquitted him, and he testified he was never involved with an inmate.
Also, he didn't testify in a criminal case.
He did not testify.
Well, you said he just testified.
No, he testified in his deposition.
I thought in the criminal case he did not testify. Let me ask you about that. Was there any explanation offered in the criminal trial for all the telephone calls, collect calls?
That was a stipulation in the criminal trial. And to go back to the comparative evidence, because that's also
important. Let's not
say that. Explanation, not the calls were made. There's no question. There
right.
were 100 made and some 25 accepted or something.
There was no...
Was there an explanation made during that criminal trial for why those calls were made?
Not in the criminal trial, but in his deposition in the civil case, yes.
He didn't testify in the criminal trial, so we don't know what his version was under oath during that trial.
Right. He did not testify in the criminal trial. He did testify in the civil case, and he gave an explanation which went undisputed as to why he accepted those calls. And that it also was not a violation of the general order. But going back to Your Honor's question with respect to Officer Usiak, it specifically states in the record, in the report, Usiak was informed he was not advised of his Miranda rights. He was informed he was free to leave. He was further advised he could refuse to answer any questions. He was informed of the sexually explicit letter that he wrote to detainee Rock that she was while she was incarcerated. That's in their report. They have all of this evidence.
I was actually raising a different point, but anyway, I see.
How do you get around the Levenstein case and the constructive discharge issue? I mean, he quit before the internal investigation could run its course. And
right.
That case says that situation cannot amount to a constructive discharge.
Right, and the Levenstein case is only applying to due process. I'd ask this court to look at Pennsylvania State Police versus Souter's Supreme Court case. Souter's supervisor arrested her for theft of her own computer skills exam papers. The court found in that case that there was an issue of fact on the constructive discharge. There are numerous cases by this court with less evidence than here, where he is arrested, he's prosecuted, he is threatened to be put in a maximum security section.
Yeah, but those are activities of the state's attorney, not the defendants in this case.
They are not, Your Honor, they are not activities of the state's attorney. You have to look at what the evidence was that was submitted. This court and the Supreme Court have held in Malley versus Briggs that if false information or not providing all of the information to the state's attorney's office, that you can be subject to equal protection claims, malicious prosecution claims. It does not insulate the defendant.
Well, and the only evidence of the maximum security thing I thought was hearsay.
Your Honor,
that's, of course, not where he's put. He's put in the medical unit. He's released. He bonds out after a few hours.
Right. However, a jury is entitled to consider that evidence, and it was
hearsay.
A statement based upon a sergeant, which, pursuant to the federal rules of evidence, could be an admission against a party.
I don't know. I think there's a serious issue there.
Right. And it's
anyway, if you want to save a little bit of time for rebuttal, I would suggest this.
Thank you, Your Honor. Time.
Mr. Gallagher.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Daniel Gallagher. I'm appearing on behalf of the defendants. May it please the court, counsel. The defendants are Michael Sheehan, the sheriff, Callie Baird, who was the acting administrative director, executive director of the CCDOC, Scott Kurtovich, who was the predecessor acting director.
So Michael Sheehan in his individual capacity, because, of course, the sheriff's
right.
turns over.
None of those people, and Scott Kurtovich, who was also the acting executive director, none of those people had anything to do with this investigation of this individual. They did not turn any information over to the state's attorney or to the prosecuting authorities. The only person.
What about Katie Harrison's statement about getting rid of all the men on Division 4? I mean, surely we have cases that suggest that kind of gender-based job assignment policy is troublesome. could violate the Constitution, even if it manages to squeak by as a BFOQ.
Well, there's part of it is the statement was allegedly made in January by Katie Harrison, and Mr. Swernigan, three times under oath, said that statement was made in January, and the action against him, if you want to call it that, was in August. And
well, there is an action against him. He's de-deputized. He is transferred to something. And whatever you may think of the transfer of job responsibilities, it seems to me a rational trier of fact might think that being de-deputized, whatever that means, is an adverse job action.
It de-deputized, though, it means he had pay. He was being paid, and he wasn't it received. There was no reduction in salary, and the only thing he couldn't do was work actually in the facility.
No, I mean, I understand that he was being paid, and you have Loudermill hearings and things like that that were going, which you know he opts out of, and Levenstein is a big problem for him in that respect. But I guess I'm just focusing on whether the act of being de-deputized could be considered an adverse employment action. Seems to me there is something adverse about it.
I think that under the circumstances, since he was being paid, it was a Loudermill situation. This is the same thing that happened to Uziak. As counsel was talking about, Officer Uziak was put on paid leave as well.
So was Uziak, quote, de-deputized?
Yes, and he was put on paid leave, and he resigned. So did Anthony. As the court pointed out earlier, there were 20 people involved. There was actually action taken against four of the 20 people. The action that was taken was against Swernigan L., Iganamwan, Anthony, and Uziak. And Uziak resigned, as did Swernigan. For whatever reason, the state's attorney chose not to bring charges against Uziak. And I think it was because of the situation that the court brought up. There was no proof that he had actually had sexual relations with one of the inmates while she was at the county jail.
And that timing is still seriously attenuated, as I understand it. The Harrison comment was in January, and the de-deputization was in July?
July. The end of July, beginning of August. Correct. So there's no, it's a tenuous situation as well. Also, with respect to saying, I don't want to have men in here if I have problems with the men, I think having men in a correctional institution under Torres case says that that is a bona fide occupational qualification in certain instances.
It can be. I mean, the Constitution doesn't have a BFOQ in it. Instead, you have United States against Virginia, and you have to look for an extremely compelling justification.
And this was different, too, Judge, because in the Torres case, although the court upheld it as a BFOQ, they said, you know, we're not going to do this. We're not saying this is blanket like this. There has to be some reason. But in that case, that was the Techita facility up in Wisconsin, and they said no men could work there, period, at the prison, at the entire prison. That wasn't the situation here. The situation here was Harrison was saying, if I have trouble with these men, I'm going to get these men out of here. They're going to go to another division within the jail. That's not a job action in that it's the same.
That's just the identical job in a different division, similar security levels, et cetera.
Absolutely. And when it was ultimately put into position after August of 2003, what happened was the men were kept out of the women's living units. Men still worked in the hallways, the external operations, transportation officers, but not in the living units. And then subsequently, of course, Division 4 isn't even a woman's division anymore. It was changed to Division 3 because it's more of a dormitory-style setting. And once again, men can bid for the jobs in Division 3, but they can't be in the living units. They can only be in the hallways or as transportation officers or as guards on the door. So it was never a post where they did get rid of all the men anyway.
Okay, so I want to follow up for just a minute about the role of the sheriff's office and the role of the state's attorney, because if the employer here had been anyone but somebody like the sheriff or the police, it's very clear that it's up to the state's attorney to decide how to investigate. It's up to the state's attorney to decide who they're going to charge. given that it's the sheriff, there's a bit of role blending because, of course, the sheriff is an enforcement arm for the state's attorney in part. And if sheriff's officers are reporting certain results of investigations to the state's attorney, it may be more complex situation than we usually have.
Let me explain how the sheriff's office is organized. Under the sheriff's office, there's three divisions. There's court services, who are the people who guard the courts. There's the corrections department, and there's the sheriff's police department. Those are three separate departments within the sheriff's office. Each one of those departments has their own head, chief of police, executive director. Each one of those organizations has their own general orders, which go to the mission that they have, and each one has their own separate IED. Once this complaint was made by Nicole Burns, this triggered a process which had been in place for a long time to handle just this type of thing. Nicole Burns gave the letter to Katie Harrison. She made an incident report and gave it to IAD. It was the IAD within the Department of Corrections. Superintendent or Investigator Kaufman, who was the head of the IAD at that time, he's passed away since, he did exactly what he was supposed to do. He reviewed it. When he found that it implicated also the criminal law, there was a separate two parallel tracks, one the administrative discipline track, and the other one was turned over to the state's attorney's office, and that went to the sheriff's police department, not the Department of Corrections, not court services, not the sheriff's office downtown, but the police department.
And there's no evidence of any information sharing between the administrative processes in the Department of Corrections subunit, if you will, and the police unit or the state's attorney?
The only issue is Miriam Rentis, who was an investigator for the IAD, interviewed some of these people. One of the officers who was a investigator for the sheriff's police department said from time to time, he mentioned to Kaufman that the investigation was still pending. And the reason for that is when there's a criminal investigation, the administrative investigation is kept dormant so as not to interfere with the criminal investigation. The criminal investigation was turned over immediately to the state's attorney's office. Two experienced state's attorneys were appointed, Lauren Freeman and Sherry LaCrone. And as they both testified, they were the ones who made the charging decisions in this case. The sheriff did not make the charging decisions. Even further, officers Murray and Slayton, I think is the other fellow's name, when they were deposed, they both testified they actually wanted more people to be indicted. They thought that there was perhaps sufficient information that the state's attorney could have indicted or sought charges against other people, but the state's attorney rejected their thoughts.
Well, and perhaps for good reason.
Perhaps for good reason. And said, so that just shows you, though, there was no control by the sheriff's office over who was going to be charged and who wasn't going to be charged.
Now, it does seem to me somewhere near the center of Mr. Swernigan L's whole case is the fact that he was, in fact, acquitted when he's brought up on criminal charges. And this was a trial, as I recall, to the court, right?
It was a bench trial.
Bench trial. Does the record reflect any remarks by the judge? I assume that would be a matter of public record upon the occasion of the acquittal. Does he explain it all, or does he say acquitted?
He explained to some extent. He makes a few mentions, and he says something about he mentions the idea of consent, which there can be no consent under the statute. So, but you know that's the situation. I don't know exactly what the judge's reasoning was, but one thing that's been left out of this whole thing, talking about somebody who was influenced to testify. Portia Warrington testified in this case. She was obviously someone who lived there.
She's the one who makes all the phone calls, right?
Right. But one of the things we overlooked, there was testimony by a woman named Markeisha Johnson. And Markeisha Johnson came and testified from the women's facility at Dwight. She wasn't under the influence of the Cook County Department of Corrections. She didn't reside in the Cook County Department of Corrections anymore. She was an inmate down at the Illinois Department of Corrections. There's nothing that could have been promised her or any kind of coercion or anything of that nature. She came up from Dwight and also testified against Swernigan that when she was residing at the Cook County Jail, she had sex with him in the Cook County Jail.
In Illinois, is it required that both the state and the defendant consent to a jury waiver, as it is in Wisconsin?
No. No.
So one side, if the defendant wants it.
Defendant wants it.
That's it.
That's correct. If there's any other questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
No, I think not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Kurtz? You have 2 minutes.
Just briefly, Your Honors, the evidence in the record shows that under General Order 4.1 and all of the evidence, testimony from supervisors, from the investigators, from Miriam Rentis, that in order to arrest a correctional officer, in order to prosecute them criminally, in order to submit that information to the state's attorney's office, it has to go through the sheriff, Chief Kaufman, and the director, Callie Baird. That is the evidence in this record that must go before a jury in order to determine disputed issues of fact. Also, Warrington denied initially at the criminal trial record, at the record 242, PL 774 through 776, testified in the criminal trial that she initially denied having sex with Officer Swearingen, and that it was not until she was offered a deal and maliciously pursued did she change her testimony. I ask that the court look at the record in this case. We try to set that out in the reply brief of the disputed issues of fact, including direct evidence, statements from Katie Harrison that she was out to get Officer Swearingen, also the supplemental record that shows that Paul Usiak was treated differently. He was not criminally prosecuted. He did not have that information submitted to the state's attorney.
But as Judge Sykes said, I mean, whether he was criminally prosecuted or not was entirely out of the hands of the sheriff's office personnel.
That's not true, Your Honor.
It is true.
The sheriff's office, pursuant to General Order 4.1, has to submit that information to the state's attorney's office, and the supplemental appendix shows.
They cannot force the state's attorneys to indict. They can't enforce the state's attorneys to go forward.
I agree, but they can withhold information from the state's attorney, which they did, with respect to Officer Usiak.
I don't see where your evidence is that in the state's attorney's independent investigation there was that kind of behavior.
Your Honor, in fact, Investigator Murray, and I see my time has expired.
You can finish this one thought.
Investigator Murray testified that Kaufman, who was the head of ID, would determine what action would have to be taken with respect to their investigation.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under advisement.